Taking Stock with Susan Hayes Cullerton.
With Nifty Business, the fleet management specialists. Keeping your business fleet moving with service you can count on.
This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Cullerton and this is the show that looks at business and economics from a wider perspective. Coming up on today's show, why Switzerland is considering putting a cap on its population, why the tariff war is still raging, and we're going to hear about Section 122, Trump's latest go-to provision. Plus, we're going to talk to the godfather of document management, John Mancini, about the rapid pace of digital transformation. You can email the show, takingstock@newstalk.com, or you can message me on socials at Susan Hayes Cullerton. This week, in my explainer, I want to highlight how we sometimes use different terms for the same thing. A headline caught my eye this week. It was in the FT and it said the UK government debt sales are set to fall for the first time in 4 years. The reason it caught my eye is that we haven't seen debt fall in the UK for quite some time. 4 years, in fact. But in other words, it's expected that the government will borrow £304 billion in this fiscal year, and next year it's expected to need only £247 billion. Now, if that headline was the sales of UK sovereign bond issues are expected to fall for the first time in 4 years, it would have meant the same thing. The word sovereign is another word for government, and the word bond is another word for borrowing. So the next time you hear about a country issuing sovereign debt, you'll know it's simply the country is borrowing more. When the news broke last week that the Supreme Court in the US had struck down Donald Trump's tariffs as unlawful, some might have breathed a sigh of relief. However, the president quickly invoked new tariffs under Section 122 of the Trade Act, creating more uncertainty for businesses and consumers around the world. Now, I'm joined by Enda Curran of Bloomberg News in Washington, D.C., to discuss how Donald Trump is using the Trade Act and where the tariff story could go next. So, first up, Enda, when Section 122 was actually created, it was added to the 1974 Trade Act in response to Richard Nixon's imposition of a 10% tariff in 1971. I don't think Richard Nixon's administration had the developments of last weekend in mind at the time.
No, hello, Susan. Indeed, I mean, this trade story is getting complicated, more technical, and it's quite fast moving. And as you say, we're at this point now where after that Supreme Court ruling last on President Trump's tariffs, we're at a point now where the president is saying he's going to use, as you say, what's called Section 122 of the Trade Act of 1974 to put 10% tariffs on all the goods coming to the US. And this piece of law is meant to be designed to offset a balance of payments crisis. Basically, when the US can't pay its way in the world, the jargon is fundamental international payments problems or a large and serious United States balance of payment deficit, etc. Now, this is where it gets into a whole argument among economists and legal experts saying, wait a minute, how can you use that piece of legislation to justify putting tariffs on? Because the US clearly is not in a balance of payments crisis. It hasn't run out of money, so to speak. It doesn't have a currency crisis. It's able to pay its way in the world. So even as the administration pushes ahead with these 10% tariffs, it's expected that there will be challenges to this latest decision by the president, possibly through the courts, and we could end up back through another legal process where the 122 tariffs get challenged again in all of the courts here.
Well, Enda, before we get into the next legal challenge, can we talk about the existing one? Because based on what happened last weekend, the conversation is now, as of the $130 billion that have been collected in tariffs, and by the time this comes to pass, it could be closer to $140 to $170 billion collected in tariffs. Will that money be repaid to those people and businesses that paid them?
Well, that is the big question. I mean, again, the headline after the Supreme Court ruling was companies no longer have to pay these tariffs to importers, and they will be able to look for ways to get their money back. Now, the Supreme Court did not rule that they can get refunds, but the thinking is, the implication being, well, if they struck down the tariffs, surely in the lower courts you can argue the case that then if those tariffs were illegal, I need to get my money back. But the president made clear last week that he's going to fight that through the courts. So those companies, and in particular small businesses that we speak to a lot here, they've had to spend tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars on these import duties to get their goods into the US. They're the ones who really have felt the brunt of it. They're the ones who are pursuing these court cases to try and A, stop the tariffs, and B, get their money back. But it's not clear it's going to be a linear process for them. It looks like it's going to have to go through the courts again before they get to that point of refunds. We don't know how long that will take. So it just adds to this idea of yet more uncertainty. And, you know, Susan, let's not forget that even if they get through the process of getting their money back, at some point, they're probably going to be back under the old tariff, under a blanket of new tariffs that the president will roll out through other parts of the Trade Act here as well. So it's a very uncertain time. It doesn't mean that the tariff story is over in the US.
I have to smile at your term linear process. There is nothing, Enda, that suggests a linear process about any of this. But you're talking there about spending a lot of money on the tariffs themselves. But of those businesses that you're talking to on the ground in Washington and beyond, are they also spending money on figuring out if they actually owe them?
Well, the compliance process here can be complicated. It can be quite technical because, you know, sometimes a tariff can be placed on a good that's stacked on top of an existing tariff, and there might be separate tariffs that cover components of a good. So, for example, if you're bringing in something that has steel and aluminium in it, you're going to have to pay those tariffs as well. It's called this kind of stacking process. So you need to figure out how much do I owe the government here in terms of duties on what I'm bringing in at the docks. And it's a very serious matter because these companies have to make sure that they are complying with the Customs and Border Protection rules on this. There's been a boom time for trade lawyers, I can tell you. But these small companies, when you speak to them, they'll say, look, multinational corporations, they can afford this. They can absorb this into their margins. They can shuttle around supply chains, or they can talk to their suppliers and have more leverage with them and so on and so forth. And of course, they have big in-house legal teams. But these smaller companies that import widgets and gadgets, either to make things here or to sell on as a finished product, those are the ones who are saying it's an extra burden on them. They're just having to spend a lot of time filling out paperwork and figuring it out. So it's expensive and it's time consuming. Now, I should say, by the way, to be clear, the White House says all of this is necessary. The US is running a record trade deficit, and this is what's required to bring production back to America. And that's where the debate comes down, Susan.
Well, can we investigate that then, Enda? Because the US net international investment position is $26 trillion in the red. So could you explain what that means to us and whether the words that are being issued by the White House then merit the action they're taking?
Well, essentially what it means is that the US is effectively, it's running a trade deficit with the rest of the world. It's buying much more from the rest of the world than it is selling to the rest of the world. This is a particular source of contention with the president, with current President Trump. And, of course, the fact that he's pursuing this very aggressive policy agenda to attract more foreign investment into the US is all part of his story, too. I mean, we've seen, don't forget, in the lead up to the Supreme Court ruling, we've seen very aggressive trade deals with current countries around the world. For example, with Japan, who was forced to promise to put hundreds of billions of US dollars into the US. You've had a similar kind of negotiation with Korea. You've had, of course, the EU. Less clear there, of course, that trade agreement is being suspended at the moment, but the EU, there was conversation there around putting money into the US. All of this goes to President Trump's central argument that the US has to get its trade deficit in order. It has to rein it in. He's of the view that the rest of the world is ripping them off, and the only way to do this is via tariffs. And if you go via tariffs, you'll promote both more foreign investors come into the US and bring more US companies back to set up shop here as well. So that's their view, but there are plenty of economists who say tariffs aren't the way to achieve that.
Well, whatever economists might say, there's no doubt about it, Trump firmly believes in this. And what I am wondering, Enda, is does he accept the ruling that the Supreme Court issued last week, or was the fact that he is now putting the 10%, then the 15%, then back to the 10% tariff and the global rate, is this also going back to the Supreme Court saying, look, you might say what you're saying, I'm powering on anyway?
Well, I mean, he's accepting it. He was very critical of the Supreme Court justices who ruled against him. He was very dismissive and he used very strong language, as he's prone to do. But nonetheless, the levers he's now pulling are through existing legal means. I mean, yes, of course, you can argue over whether or not the 122 is the correct route, but it's there, it's on the books. And the point here, Susan, that's a temporary measure. These are duties for up to 150 days. Once they get beyond that, there will be other levers that a president can pull to get tariffs in place. There are other sections of various trade acts. I don't want to get into too many numbers and to lose your listeners, but the one everyone's thinking about here is called the Section 301. So that's where you have an investigation into a product or a sector. You might say, hey, look, this foreign competitor is dumping cheap products in here. We need to fix that. We need to protect our industry. You bring those companies into Congress. They have a hearing. And the end result is that the White House says, look, we need tariffs to protect that sector and that industry, and we'll put them on via 301. And that's why, ultimately, a lot of people following this think that eventually we'll get back to tariffs close to where they were before the Supreme Court ruling. Right here, right now, it's confusing. Tariffs are up, tariffs are down. But once they follow this existing legal process, using these acts that are on the books in Congress through the trade laws, there's a feeling that they'll get back to the effective tariff rate being somewhere close to where it was before the Supreme Court ruling. And that's maybe somewhere around maybe around 15% effective tariff rate on all the goods coming to the US.
Last April, Linda, we had Liberation Day. There was a massive uncertainty until that trade deal between the EU and the US was agreed in July. And then while the agreement was agreed, it wasn't ratified in the European Parliament, as you mentioned. Now it has been suspended. But is the message here, look at whatever has gone on in the news from last July until now, pretty much put it out of your head. That's what the tariff is going to be. And that's just it.
I think that's what the administration is guiding. I mean, so clearly a lot of deals were made with foreign governments before the Supreme Court ruling. Naturally, a foreign government is going to say, wait a second, what have we agreed here? And what's valid in our ruling? Then the EU is part of that mix. They're just pressing pause to say, where do these tariff levels end up? But the messaging from the White House has been, look, stick with the deals that we have made. There may be some recalibration on some goods, some products as they go through this process, but ultimately they're going to get tariffs back up to where they were. But the irony here, Susan, is that right here, right now, because of the Supreme Court ruling, you've seen tariffs drop on so-called US competitive adversaries. So like tariffs on Chinese goods, for example, have actually fallen as a result of the Supreme Court ruling. But tariffs on allies like the UK and Australia, even though they have trade agreements, those tariffs have increased, even if marginally. So it's a perplexing situation for trading partners of the US. There are clearly winners, there are clearly losers, but the White House is guiding that, yes, this is a bump in the road, but we're going to pull our own internal levers here and basically land where we were more or less before that Supreme Court ruling.
You're right about the winners and losers and the unintended consequences of a blunt instrument like that. And while we have you, could I also just ask you about the reaction to the State of the Union address that happened this week? I mean, as I was watching it, Trump was highlighting that incomes are increasing quickly. He was saying inflation is falling quickly, and he was pouring scorn on the term affordability because it has a real Democrat-type connotation now. It sounds like he does feel that everyone in America is flying. What's your reaction to that, or what do you feel the reaction on the ground is?
Well, every president will talk up their economic agenda. I mean, their first role is to talk up confidence, Susan. But, you know, the opinion polls indicate that voters are not happy with economic management on the ground. And where the administration is getting stuck is that even though the rate of inflation obviously has slowed from where it was a few years ago during the Biden years, during the pandemic, the rate of inflation may have slowed, but prices are still high. And in fact, in some pockets of the grocery store, prices are still going up. The prices for beef here are soaring, for example. And so this is feeding back into the political cycle. Voters are unhappy at the cost of living here. It's putting pressure on the administration. Clearly, President Trump doesn't necessarily agree with that. He said he's pulling the levers that he's pulling to get prices down, or at least to slow the pace of inflation. But it's a thorny topic. It hasn't gone away, and it looks like being an essential one for the midterm elections when they come up in November.
That's where all roads are leading to end, isn't it? It's the midterm.
It's very important. It'll be, you know, the ultimate sort of midterm judgment on
referendum
the
referendum of sorts. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Just like a by-election at home.
It has been fascinating to talk to you. And there is so much here that is going on with this US administration, even in the past couple of days. And I'm sure that's going to continue into the days ahead. Thank you very much for joining me, Enda Curran of Bloomberg News in Washington, D.C.
Thank you, Susan.
This is Susan A's Culleton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. After the break, how Switzerland plans to tackle its population growth. Welcome back to Taking Stock. I'm Susan A's Culleton. Now, for my trivia this week. Which county was the number one renewable energy producing county in January? Now, I'm going to give you a clue. It is 2.3% of the landmass of the country. I'll give you the answer at the end of the show. Now, a referendum mandating the Swiss government to impose a population cap to keep the population of the country under 10 million is set to be held on June 10th. The proposal from the far-right Swiss People's Party has been criticised for having potentially devastating consequences to the economy and Switzerland's relationship with the European Union. Joining me now to discuss the proposal and its potential consequences is Julia Hamilton, a freelance journalist based on the ground there in Switzerland. First of all, Julia, where is this coming from?
Yes, that's right. So this proposal is coming from the far-right Swiss People's Party called the SVP. They are the largest political party in Switzerland, and they are known for their anti-immigration stance. And so, so they put this proposal forward for a referendum. And in Switzerland, it's always the people who decide on major legislation. So there will be a referendum, and people will have the chance to vote yes or no to this initiative. And yes, the initiative is capping the population at 10 million. And right now the population is 9.1 million. And so once that reaches 9.5 million, then the government would have to act if this proposal gets through.
I see where you're coming from when you mentioned that the government is bringing this, but it has to be coming from people as well if it is going to actually happen based on how referenda are decided. So what's the mood on the ground around this question that will be put to the people?
Well, because they are the largest political party, so of course they have an influence on the population. And actually, around 27%, as it stands of now, of population in Switzerland is not actually Swiss citizens. So it's quite a high population of non-Swiss citizens here. And of course, they are involved heavily in the employment and in the economy. And actually, in Switzerland, there are so many international organizations. Of course, Geneva is home to the United Nations offices and various international organizations. And there are many multinational organizations in other regions of Switzerland as well. So there are so many international talent employed in Switzerland. But in the last, let's say, decade or so, because the population has been growing and has been growing quite fast, so the sentiment, the kind of anti-immigration sentiment has been growing, especially in rural areas of Switzerland. So yes, even though this referendum will be up for debate or the vote by the people here, but remains to be seen, of course, how many will say yes.
Okay, let's walk through the scenarios then of if a yes vote was decided upon. We have looked at immigration conversations around the world, in the UK, in Australia, etc. Is this a blunt instrument, Julia, where if over like the 10 millionth and first person would simply not be allowed in, or would it be dependent upon skills or ethnicity, or how would this work?
Yes, yeah, so according to the proposal, the cap is at 10 million people. So that means that as soon as it reaches 9.5 million, then the government will have to propose some initiatives, and that could involve putting some caps on employment or on permits, or not allowing family reunification, and various different other ways. But actually, in Switzerland, it's not so easy to actually just come and live here. Switzerland already has quite a restrictive labour market. For example, for a non-EU person to come to Switzerland, they have to have a job, a contract, because they have to apply for a permit. And initially that is a work permit, which of course is tied to your job. And then after 5 years, that could be extended to a residence permit. So very much a person, especially non-EU citizens, when they come to Switzerland, they're very much tied to their jobs. And so, if this vote does go through, then as soon as the population goes over 9.5 million, then the government will have to provide some forms of some measures to cap the population.
However, if it went to 10 million, which is the tagline related to this referendum, what would happen then?
Well, that's right. So I guess this is the thing. So they will have to already take measures before it reaches 10 million people. And that means potentially that some people could have their permits stopped or refused or any kind of from non-EU. Of course, Switzerland is very much tied to the EU and it has a freedom of movement with its European neighbors. So also there are quite a few considerations for this as well. So how will they be deporting people? How will they be refusing permits? On which ground? So all of this, of course, will be quite interesting to watch if that actually does happen.
I mean, there's a lot of accountability in doing that then, Julia. As you say, it's one thing to stop people coming in. It's a whole other story to stop things like the interaction with the EU, freedom of movement of people, etc. I do want to ask you, though, as you say, the population is currently 9.1 million. And when I was looking at this, the Swiss population has grown about five times faster than the average in surrounding EU member states over the past decade. What is Switzerland doing so well that you all want to live there?
Well, yes. So Switzerland is actually has this reputation as a kind of island of wealth, if you like. So people believe that when you get a job in Switzerland, you therefore will have a higher salary. And while it is true, on average, Swiss salaries are higher than that of many other European countries, but the costs of living are very high in Switzerland as well. So this is something that people maybe not necessarily understand, is that taxation here is quite high. The social benefits, the social costs here are quite high. We even have to have this mandatory health insurance, which can cost something like 300, 400, 500 francs plus a month. And that's a huge addition on each member of the family, for example. So yes, as a family of four or five people, that's a huge cost. Of course, things like schools and preschools, they all cost a lot of money as well. So the cost of living in Switzerland is actually quite high, even though the salaries seem on paper like they are quite nice.
So the cost of living is high, the bar to get in outside of the EU is high, but as you say, then the social benefits and the salaries offer the other side of that. So if we look now at, we've looked at the impact of if this did go through, can we just explore how likely it is to go through? Because a poll in December showed 48% support for the no to 10 million plan. How is that evolving? Because that number that I got there is from a couple of months ago now.
Yes, that's right. So there was a support, according to this poll that was done in December, there was a support from about 48% of voters for this initiative. And sure, there was the sentiment is quite divided here and it's more coming from rural areas of Switzerland. But then at the same time, quite a lot of the initiatives proposed by the SVP party, the Swiss People's Party, they actually have about 10% of popular 10% of pass. So yes, at the moment, maybe it seems like it is quite high, but actually when it comes to the poll itself in June, we'll just have to see. But quite often these referendums in Switzerland, they are very, they could end up with 51% of a yes or vice versa. So yes, we'll have to watch what happens, but it could be quite a close call.
And if it goes through, let's say, from the people's vote, is that it then? Does it happen or is there any other amendments or any other discussions that would happen at the federal level?
Well, that's right. So the people's decision, that's the final decision. And then after this, if that does go through, then of course, then the government will have to start working on that legislation and to make it into a law and so on. So that's typically how it happens here is that. But I must add that also the Swiss government is actually against this proposal. So they're not in favor. And even though that doesn't mean much in general, in overall votes, but the government can say if they are in favor or not in favor of some proposals. So, but even though if they are not in favor, they will still have to go with whatever the people's vote is.
So no matter what, if this passes, this will happen?
Exactly, yes.
Okay. And then what would the impact be then on the employment levels? Like, as you say, there's a lot of people working in Switzerland. And so, of course, if they're working, they're employed there. So what would be the likely impact on sectors like finance, of which Switzerland is well known, or pharma or healthcare or construction, many of whom really rely on foreign labour?
Absolutely. So Switzerland has a very high demand for skilled foreign labour. In fact, almost 2 million foreign nationals, as of figures from late 2025, they come largely from the EU. And that's like almost 80% of those workers. So, sectors like the tech, the banking, pharma, they employ a lot of international talent. So, of course, if And this is why the government and why many business leaders are against this proposal, because they say that, well, if that goes through, then that will really restrict being able to have the required international talent for many of these companies in many of these sectors. So, it could have a huge impact on the economy, on many of the sectors here. The pharmaceutical sector relies heavily on international talent and many others as well. So for sure, business leaders, they are against this, and they say that there is a reason for why they are against it, because they employ international talent for a reason, because they have certain qualifications, certain experience. And if that is taken away from them, then that could threaten Swiss competitiveness and innovation.
If government is against this and business leaders are against this, who is for it, Julia? How could you characterize that for us?
Well, this is the thing. So it comes from a political party which is known for its anti-immigration policies. So, but then in the end, it's of course will have to be the people who decide in the end whether the rural population has more of a say than that in cities. We'll have to see.
Well, when we look at an issue that we also face here in Ireland, which is that we don't have as much housing for people, both people living here and people coming into the country as we would like, I'm sure that's shared in Switzerland. But to what extent are housing shortages or are public service pressures genuinely driven by immigration versus things like, say, domestic planning policy or zoning laws or investment gaps or affordability?
Well, yes. So that's actually also quite a big problem in Switzerland as well with the housing shortage, because of the population has been growing so fast in the last decade that in many cities like Geneva, Zurich and many other Basel and even smaller cities, towns around the country, they are all facing housing crisis. And I have experienced this myself. For example, if you want to rent an apartment in a place like Geneva, you potentially end up being in a queue with 20 people in front, and you must have a very good contract, very good salary, and so on to be considered as as one of the first people considered for this rental. So so yes, indeed, there is quite a high competition for accommodation here, and that is also, of course, affecting the locals, who are, and that's where the sentiment is coming from.
And if this did come to pass, and I mean the extreme version of this, where it would get to the 10 million actual cap and where freedom of movement would be restricted in the EU. I mean, when I think about the relationship that the EU and Switzerland has had and how hard won it has been to get regulation in place, given its particular role, what sort of consequences do you see happening with that relationship if that cap was triggered?
Well, I mean, of course, then because Switzerland has such strong ties with the EU, so of course that will have a very big impact on relations with its neighbours, because Switzerland is bordering Germany, France, Italy, and there are even places like Geneva, for example. It's known as the cross-border town, so there are quite a lot of people who are coming to work in Geneva, but they live in France. So that will have a huge impact, of course, on the neighbours and on the permit system and on employment here. It will have a huge impact on its relations with, because of course the freedom of movement, that's one of the huge initiatives in the EU, and Switzerland is still obliging by this. So it has favorable conditions for, first of all, it's the Swiss national who gets priority when a contract has been offered, then it's the EU national, and then it's the person from the third country. So first, relations with the EU could potentially suffer.
And is that enshrined into HR law, that hierarchy?
Yes, this is the according to the movement, freedom of movement. For example, I can give an example with Brexit in the UK. So I myself am British national, and I came here before 2019. So I actually have on my Swiss permit, I have a remark which says that I arrived here before Brexit. So therefore, I still have the same rights as EU citizens. But then a person from a third country, even if they want to come to Switzerland now, first of all, there is a cap on how many people can be employed from third countries, in fact from each country as well. So and it's quite difficult to for a Swiss company to prove the necessity to hire a person from a third country. They have to pay some money for the visas, they have to prove that this is the only person with the required qualifications and so on. But it gets easier for EU citizens, and then of course the easiest is the Swiss nationals. They have the priority.
All of which would get far more complicated should this pass, of course.
Absolutely.
The other thing I wanted to ask you about is this is one of two questions in the referendum. The other question, could you tell us what it is and is it getting any attention?
Yes, so actually there is a question of the reform of the civilian service as well. So that will be the No to 10 Million Switzerland initiative, and then the reform of civilian service. Both of them will be discussed in this referendum. But the second vote concerns a plan to tighten the rules for accessing civilian service. This reform has been approved by the parliament and is intended to curb the number of recruits switching from the army to civilian service. And the government actually wants to reduce annual admissions from around 6,600 to about 4,000. So, yes, so there will be several big initiatives in this vote in June.
Do you think this suggests the overall conversation around the immigration side of things? I just want to prioritise that in this conversation. Is it a genuine shift in public sentiment on immigration? As you say, the anti-immigration sentiment has been rising. Or do you think is it a broader political strategy by the SVP to shape the national agenda, even if the initiative ultimately fails?
Well, yes, I would say that overall, because Switzerland has such a high population of non-Swiss citizens here, that of course the sentiment is divided. So while many other companies understand the importance of having international talent working and living here, but the others are thinking along the lines that, well, they're taking our jobs, they're taking our accommodation, and they're taking whatever it may be. So there's a division. So, like, I would say that in rural areas, this sentiment is higher than that in cities, because of course people in big cities like Zurich and Geneva, they're used to foreign people living, foreign nationals living in these places. But I would say that overall, I wouldn't say that in Switzerland there is a very big anti-immigration sentiment, but it's certainly growing.
You've really given us a rounded insight there into what's going on in the country. And the 10th of June is a date that we will watch with interest, but also in all of the developments that lead to whatever decision that the overall population come up with. Thank you very much for joining me, Julia Hamilton, a freelance journalist based in Switzerland.
Thank you, Susan.
This is Susan Hayes Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, we hear from a fascinating man called John Mancini, who is going to be talking about everything from AI to his grandparents' immigration story. Now, you're welcome back to Taking Stock here on News Talk. I'm Susan Hayes Cullerton. As businesses, do you think about how you manage your documents and keep them secure? Because next month, Dublin will host the Document Management and AI Leadership Summit, and my next guest will be a keynote speaker. So it's great to welcome John Mancini, the President of Content Results. John, I see that this conference is billed whereby we're invited to imagine a world where documents think, processes predict, and information flows like never before, where intelligent document processing doesn't just streamline, it transforms entire business ecosystems. Now tell us, John, what does that mean?
Doesn't it sound like a wonderful world now?
It certainly does.
It'll be a great event. The URL for anybody that hasn't registered is the documentmanagementsummit.com on the 25th of March. And the world that you talk about is really one that we have been aspiring to for 40 years. And we've gone through a number of iterations of technology. And all of that I was a part of. I was a president of AIM, which is the Association for Information Management, for a long time. And I saw all of those, and I saw a lot of mistakes along the way. But that promise has always existed, that if we could get our information, particularly if we could get our content under control, that we would have a situation where processes would work more effectively, customers would be more satisfied, we would be better in compliance with government rules and regulations, and our businesses would run more efficiently.
But transforming an entire business ecosystem to me sounds like it would also have a transformative effect on operations or sales or managing people or managing finance. How does document management contribute to something like that?
It contributes directly, because when you think about any business process, you think about any business department and what makes it work or what makes it not work. And the common denominator of all that are people and information and technology. And document management is where the three of those come together.
And to what end, though? That's what I'm wondering, John, is that when you bring them all together, to what end?
Well, to the end of basically transforming the organization, because organizations can't really survive, particularly in an AI era, if their business processes are manual, if their content still resides in the form of paper or unmanaged documents, if their people are struggling to try to figure out where information is and what's the right piece of information and get that information in a timely manner, all of those things come together that create a business imperative to dramatically look differently at how you manage information in order to facilitate business change.
I would argue, though, John, we did that with the cloud. What's different now?
Well, I don't mean to imply, that's a good question, Susan. I don't mean to imply that this is a journey that has a distinct end or even one that necessarily we are close to. As I said, I've been doing this a long time. The content business has been through a number of iterations. And one of the challenges that we have is that each iteration of technology doesn't replace the one prior, but it builds upon it. And so it's like it's stacking technology on top of each other, which creates opportunities to address the problems, but it also creates a host of new problems because you haven't resolved them in the first stage. You know, just look, for example, 30, 40 years ago, everybody's information was in the form of paper. You know, you would like to think that we solved that problem when we went to the cloud, when we went to scanners, when we went to, you know, all sorts of automated technology. But the fact of the matter, if you look at most organizations, they still have boxes and boxes of paper floating around.
Okay. And when we moved from, say, paper to cloud, and now we're looking at AI, you talk about some new problems that can be created by stacking one technology on top of another. Wouldn't challenge that arises as one goes through that journey then, John, would be cybersecurity. Because, of course, if all of your documents are digitized, then they're susceptible to cyber hacking or otherwise. What advice do you have for organizations who would be worried that if everything gets digitized, then everything is up for grabs?
Well, that's a good question. I would argue that everything is already up for grabs, you know, whether it's in a physical world in which, you know, we rely on security like locking file cabinets, or whether it's available on the cloud and we try to protect it through security systems. You know, it all gets back to the whole question of how do you protect the information? How do you do it at an asset specific level? And how do you address the people problem in all of this?
And what's the people problem?
The people problem is that we tend to put all of our eggs in the technology basket rather than the people side. We tend to treat governance as an afterthought. It's something that we think about later because, you know, we're so eager to get moving with the productivity side that we neglect the security side. We're so focused on big bang implementations, huge implementations, rather than view this as a series of things that connect to each other, but don't necessarily represent an end to themselves. And we often approach these problems without executive sponsorship. And so executives give lip service to the concept of security, but many of them don't act in a way that reflects that.
I noticed when I was looking at your own background within the Association for Intelligent Information Management, John, you said that You're going to share your perspective on the future direction of the industry and what organizations should be preparing for next. Can I ask you what you think organizations currently are doing wrong or underappreciating?
Well, I think they're underappreciating the importance of thinking about governance and information governance from the very early stages of everything that they do.
And what is information governance?
Information governance is basically treating your information like you would treat any other business asset. You know, if you have important business assets, you design ways to protect them, you design ways to monitor them, you design ways to hold people accountable for how they treat them. And information has been somewhat of the odd duck in the equation. You know, we protect our plants We protect physical files, but when it comes to information, it's usually the odd man out.
Okay. And so as organizations are thinking about what to do next, let's say in an, I won't say an AI first world because we're not there yet, but in a world where, let's say, they might be managing agents as well as human resources, or where they're thinking about these cybersecurity or information governance concerns, what practical things should they be doing now?
I think what they need to do is think about, you know, what are the pillars of success that they're looking towards? And by that, I don't mean that you're going to achieve all these at the snap of a finger or just, you know, very easily. But I think what you should aspire to are four things. You should aspire to systems that are connected, you know, that don't operate in isolation. You should aspire to systems that focus on automating the background processes of an organization. You should focus on creating systems that have a single source of truth. That's incredibly complex as we move into the AI era, because, you know, we've all seen it in the political realm that, you know, it's ripe for information that we can't trust. But organizations need to have that focus on what is the single source of truth in their organization. And then lastly, they need to aspire to systems that have compliance built in, not something they try to bolt in after the fact, because, you know, the sheer fact of the matter is that given the volume of information that is being created, and it's cascading at levels that nobody could have predicted 10, 15, 20 years ago, if you don't build in compliance as information is being created, you don't have a chance of catching up later on.
So systems that are connected, focusing on activating background, automating background processes, single source of truth and compliance built in. I'm going to change now, John, to ask you a personal question, if I might. And
sure.
That is, you've celebrated a big birthday and it was a big deal for you to the point of where you wanted to write a book about it. Can you tell us about 70-ish?
Yes, I recently crossed that rather ignominious milestone, although I guess it's better than the alternative. And actually, it was a second book. This one was driven by the, you know, like everybody gets to a certain stage in life, they want to share the great wisdom that they've accumulated over the years. You know, the first book I did was about my immigrant Italian grandparents, which was this huge mystery in our family that we never knew about my paternal grandparents. And it was actually funny because the combination of my professional background, which spent a lot of time with records managers and archivists and people like that, you know, collided with this desire to figure out what happened to my grandparents. And so we put that book together.
And when you say about it's better than the alternative, I just want to spell that out for listeners, because, John, you have outlived your dad.
Yes, that was part of the spark behind the first book. And, you know, I was telling my wife the other day that it's a somewhat startling thing. You know, everybody, when you get to a certain point, you look in the mirror and you think, oh, my goodness, my parent is in the mirror looking back at me. And in my case, it's like, oh, my goodness, there's an older version of my parent looking back at me. And so that's kind of startling.
And what life lessons did you share in the book then? You have a full repertoire of 70 years of learning. What was your document management within that?
I think my lesson from both books, actually, and it was an extension of the lessons that I learned professionally, is that I have mad respect now for the people that we have entrusted with the problem of determining what we save and how we save it and in what form we save it, so that somebody 50, 70, 100 years from now will know what we're all about.
So that's your inspiration. It's legacy.
Yes, and it's that legacy question. You know, in the case of particularly my grandparents, and I mentioned my Italian grandparents, but it's also true of my Irish grandmother, too. We didn't really know a whole lot about her, and I've recently discovered that she was in the Caman na Mann. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right.
You're close enough. Yeah. We love an Irish granny on this show.
The Women's Auxiliary of the IRA, and she came over to the United States in 1924, and the records that were left behind have been critical to me understand, you know, she's long gone, she's gone for 40 years now, but have been critical to understanding the life that she lived, the context of that life that she had, perhaps even extrapolating a bit to the kinds of things that she worried about. And I think those lessons are ones that I'm able to tap into because somebody did a good job 100 years ago of recording all that information. And I worry about what we are doing now, given the extreme volume of information, how rapidly it's being created, how cavalier we are with how we preserve that information. What are we preserving for our grandchildren to look at, you know, 100 years from now?
And what do you want your grandchildren to know about you in case they're listening to this episode of Taking Stock in 100 years?
I hope that they will understand that I've done my best to understand the legacy that my life has been built upon. And I've done my best within a professional context to help other people record information both personally and about their organizations that will provide a sound legacy for them in the future.
Right. Well, where we started off with document management in Dublin, we finished up with an Irish granny in New York as we're hurtling into the future where your grandchildren will be listening to this, John. So for anybody who's interested, the Convergent Document Management and AI Leadership Summit is taking place on Wednesday, the 25th of March, 2026 at Chartered Accountants House, Dublin 2. And for more information, see convergent.ie. And thank you so much indeed, John Mancini, who is an author, a legacy creator and a keynote speaker. Thank you very much for joining us here on Taking Stock.
Thank you, Susan. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
Now, for the answer to my trivia, I asked you which county was the number one renewable energy producing county in January. And I gave you a clue. It is 2.3% of the land mass of the country. The answer is Offaly. It started working on this in 2009 and now is actually an exemplar in the whole area of renewable energy, not just in Ireland, but in Europe. I learned that this week and I thought I would share it with you all. That's it for this week's Taking Stock with me, Susan Hayes-Culleton. I hope you enjoyed the show and possibly even learned something about economics and how it affects our world. I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the Go Loud app. It's also on the radio every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. The producer of Taking Stock is John Fardy, and on research this week was Kate Henshaw and Simon Keane. Hugo de Silva Scott was on sound. Thanks so much for listening and enjoy the rest of your day.